So, Dominic.
Katie.
For your job, you have to sing in Italian sometimes, don't you?
Si.
And I was wondering if you could introduce us in Italian this week, because we did a lovely interview recently with an Italian newspaper, and they came up with like such a good summary of what this podcast is that I thought it would be a nice way of explaining to new listeners who we are. Do you want to have a bash at it?
I sing in Italian when I learn a score. I don't speak Italian.
This is what they said about us. Can you just read this out?
Il podcast settimanale che in mezz'ora riesce a farti entrare in Europa. Ti tiene per mano così non ti perdi e ti fa uscire con un sorriso.
Yeah, what he said.
That's terrible.
That sounded very good to me. But basically, they described us as the weekly podcast that brings you to Europe in half an hour, takes you by the hand so that you don't get lost, and leaves you with a smile. Isn't that nice?
Oh, that is nice. But I never feel like you take me by the hand, I'll be honest.
I love that you also didn't know what you just said until I said it in English. But you sounded very good to me. Anyway, thank you very much to Paola Peduzzi at Il Foglio newspaper. It was very nice talking to you. And welcome everyone else to half an hour of holding hands with us. That sounds creepy.
And it's been Europe Day this week, so...
Yeah, happy Europe Day.
Special time for us to hold hands. You were in Brussels for Europe Day, weren't you?
Was I? What day was it?
No, it was Thursday.
This is what a bad European I am. No, I wasn't. I was back in Paris.
But you were in Brussels for the second time in a fortnight. Did you have a good time?
I did. I'm like such a Brussels convert. I have been taken in by the bubble. Well, maybe not taken in by the bubble. But yeah, it's a really nice place and I had a good time. And actually, while I was there, I met someone really interesting who you're going to hear from a little bit later. The French writer Maxime Caligaro. And he's written a crime thriller set in the European Parliament, which is not the setting for many crime thrillers. Probably because most people find European institutions so deeply unsexy.
Unthrilling.
Unthrilling. But Maxime makes a really good case for the EU as an actually really interesting and underexplored place to set like TV dramas and books and stuff. And I'm looking forward to hearing what you make of his arguments a little bit later.
Sounds fun. I'm open to being convinced. I love political thrillers.
Yeah, this is good. It's got a grisly murder in it.
I also did something quite European. I just had my chat with the person I'd been matched with for Europe Talks.
Oh, did you?
Listeners might remember we interviewed Sebastian from Site Online, who was starting this project back then called Europe Talks, matching up people who have different opinions to have just a conversation. And I just had a really nice chat with a woman from Belgium, a pensioner, and the only problem was what I predicted. We agreed on everything. You had to answer questions in the run-up to it to be matched with someone who had opposing views, and we answered one question differently, but we quickly realized that was just about how we'd interpreted the question, and we actually even agreed on that.
So you just spent half an hour like having a nice time?
Just having a nice time and talking about Europe. So that was nice anyway. But I'd be interested to hear if any other listeners ended up doing it, and if so, how it goes.
My one didn't want me.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I got an email back saying, you've been matched, click on this link. And I emailed Robert from London, if you're listening. Didn't want to meet up with me, just didn't reply. So that was a little crushing. Oh. But I'm rising above it, I'm moving on.
What a douchebag.
Don't call Robert from London a douchebag. Maybe he just doesn't check his emails.
Maybe, but then don't sign up to Europe Talks.
Ooh, cold.
Anyway, let's move on from that nasty turn.
nasty Robert. Apart from Maxime, who we're going to hear from later, who else are we hearing from this week?
I also had a chat without Katie. I'm going to be speaking to the young Belgian-American journalist and Pulitzer Grant recipient, AJ Nadaf, who spent a few months in Kosovo reporting on the rehabilitation and de-radicalization of ISIS fighters returning from Syria. I wanted to speak to him in light of the news that Kosovo had repatriated over 100 citizens from Syria, which is like quite a big deal. I think they're the only country to have done a mass repatriation like that in Europe.
So that is coming up, but first... So who's had a good week, Dominic?
Well, we've got some bear news for Good Week. I actually think that bears have maybe been awarded a Good Week slot in our pod before. Maybe more bears have won Good Week than any single country.
Somebody should get us the data on that.
Somebody should, yep. We should get our data analyst to crunch the numbers. Katie, it's been a good week in Portugal where they have spotted their first brown bear in a century. And actually, that's kind of playing it down because the last brown bear in Portugal is thought to have been killed in 1843. So it's really quite a long time. It doesn't seem to be a permanent emigration of bear to Portugal, but more like a stray bear that's maybe crossed over from the Western Cantabrian mountains in northern Spain. But this Portuguese bear news is part of a bigger picture of good news that the Spanish population of brown bears seems to be on the rise. There are thought to be around 330 brown bears in the Cantabria Mountains, nowhere near the thousands that there used to be, but significantly up from just over 100 that were found in 2007. There are actually two communities of bears in this mountainous region in the north of Spain. There is one community that live on the western side of the mountains and another much smaller community in the eastern side. There is, in fact, a very interesting report from El País about the two different communities and the mystery around why the community on the east are doing so badly whilst the western bears are on the rise. Some of it is explained by the fact that the eastern bears seem to be producing fewer cubs per litter than the western cubs. If you're interested in bears, and frankly, who isn't, then it makes a good read. I'll post the link in the show notes, or Katie will for me, pretty please.
Since you're asking so nicely.
I was going to make a joke about border-free Schengen zone or something, but I couldn't bear it.
Oh, Dominic, terrible. Ugh, I don't even know how to follow that. I do think this is like really nice positive news, though, about like an immigrant bear, because in France, this is like slightly racist undercurrent, the debate over bears. Like the French government has brought in a few Slovenian lady bears over the last few years because they're really good for biodiversity.
Lady bears?
Do you think that was a bit prim the way I said that?
Yeah, I do.
She bears. But anyway, yeah, the farmers hate them because they steal sheep sometimes. And I've heard a couple of farmers on TV being like, they're not even French, these bears. They're Slovenian immigrant bears. And I just think that's quite funny.
That's, I'm sorry, I just can't get over the fact that you called them lady bears.
Lady bears.
Anyway, moving on. Who's it been a bad week for?
It has been a bad week for coup plotters in Montenegro. We don't really have attempted coups in Europe, unless you count Turkey as Europe, which I think is a debate we probably should have at some point, whether Turkey counts as Europe or not. But sticking in Europe proper, it's been a pretty bad week for the 14 people who've been handed jail sentences in Montenegro for plotting a coup to overthrow the government there back in 2016. And reading news stories about what happened, it sounds like the plot for like a Netflix series or something. It's pretty crazy. The people that were prosecuted over this include two Russian intelligence officers. And what the group were apparently planning to do was take over parliament on the day of the national elections in 2016, assassinate the prime minister at the time, Milo Djukanovic, and set up a pro-Russian government in Montenegro. Mm. Montenegro is this tiny, very beautiful and mountainous country between Bosnia and Albania on the Adriatic coast, just across the water from Italy. And for the last 30 years, it's been run by this guy, Djukanovic, as either president or prime minister. And he has steered the country very much on a pro-European course, away from the Russian sphere of influence. He's been trying to get the country into the EU. And in 2017, Montenegro joined NATO, which really pissed Russia off because Russia sees Montenegro as culturally Slavic. Most people are Orthodox Christian, so there should be allies. And this is apparently how this group of coup plotters felt, because they wanted to install a pro-Russian government in this tiny European country by force. Whether or not Russia knew about this brilliant plan is up for debate. The prosecutors in the court case certainly accused elements of the state of playing a role in the coup plot, which Moscow has said is just ridiculous. And to be fair to the Russians, like when you look at things like the nerve agent attack in England last year, it's pretty clear that the Russian state doesn't work as like one well-functioning entity. Like the left hand often doesn't know what the right hand is doing. But the two Russians who've been handed jail sentences in Montenegro, they're not actually in jail. They conveniently disappeared and the trial took place without them. They're believed to have been members of the GRU, so the Russian Military Secret Service. By the way, it would have been quite an international group taking over the government. A couple of opposition leaders from Montenegro itself and nine Serbians were also convicted. But it's really lucky that it just stayed a plot. The police in Montenegro managed to get a tip off from Western intelligence agencies over what was being planned. But it's a story that hasn't really been given that much attention. Maybe because Montenegro is like a really small country. Maybe because the coup attempts didn't succeed. But yeah, it's still pretty disturbing.
Yeah, it sounds like quite a big deal. Were they lady plotters?
Shut up. Let's go next door to Kosovo. So why did you want to talk about Kosovo this week?
I wanted to talk about Kosovo this week because of the news that Kosovo have repatriated 110 citizens from Syria, some of whom had been fighting for IS, but most of whom are actually children. This is in stark contrast to the efforts of most other European countries following the fall of the so-called caliphate. The story of Shamima Begum made headlines for a few weeks in the UK after she had her British citizenship stripped from her. She was a 15-year-old schoolgirl when she ran away from home with friends to go and live in the caliphate in Syria. We've been wanting to talk about this complex issue of repatriating and rehabilitating Europeans who have been living in the so-called Islamic State for a while. And this seemed like a good time with the news from Kosovo, and AJ Nadaf seemed like the perfect person to talk to. AJ is a Belgian citizen living in the States who received a Pulitzer grant to go and cover the problem of radicalization in Kosovo for 2 months. Kosovo is a country that had the highest per capita rate of citizens traveling to Syria to fight for IS. Some 413 Kosovar citizens are thought to have joined IS and other Islamic extremist factions out of the 1.8 million citizens of Kosovo. Katie was busy in Brussels, but I took the reins and gave AJ a call in North Carolina, where he currently lives. I wanted to ask you first if you could introduce yourself. Just tell me how you ended up reporting on Kosovo.
Truthfully, how I reported on Kosovo is 2 years ago, I knew little to nothing about Kosovo, Europe's newest country, until I came across this article in New York Times international piece, long read by Carlotta Gall, and it traces Saudi Arabia's insidious role since the end of the Kosovo War, flooding Kosovo with Wahhabi NGOs, and systematically transforming this small country into a pipeline for jihadists linked to the Syria war and Iraq as well. And so on a personal level, I'm a citizen of Belgium as well as the US, and I've been following developments of radicalization in Western Europe. So this article interests me because it was the first time I heard about ISIS influence in the Balkans, and I couldn't help but wonder whether Kosovo was moving in the same direction as Belgium. And this article sort of reinforced the influence that media can have on molding stereotypes, because suddenly this country I barely knew anything about was now on my radar as being a sort of nest for extremism. And so when I saw that almost no Western reporter had followed up on the Times piece, 1 year later, I was prompted to investigate the veracity of Gall's claims. At the same time, Kosovo is a very interesting country in terms of its demographics, because it's Muslim majority, democratic, with a secular constitution, European. So it also feels like if there is an answer to be found on de-radicalization, that Kosovo can provide it. But when I arrived in Pristina, I saw, you know, I couldn't find these extremist elements that had been reported on. It was like any other European metropole with bars, cafes, and above all, really hospitable people. So in order to do my reporting, I had to dig deep, traveling around the countryside, poorer regions. And almost everyone I spoke with in Kosovo told me again and again that Gall's New York Times piece failed to present the reality on the ground and was largely sensationalized.
Yeah, I guess that's a problem with a lot of reporting on extremism in general, that it misses out the wider picture. So you did eventually find some people to speak to who had fought for ISIS or at least been in Syria. What were your initial conclusions? What did you find from people who'd been there?
So the media has reported that Kosovo has sent the largest percentage per capita of people to Syria and to ISIS out of any Western nation. And I think that context, first of all, is sort of wrongly framed. Because since Kosovo is a Muslim-majority country, 90-95% nominally Muslim, of course there are going to be more people per capita joining this so-called Islamic extremist movement than other countries in Europe where Muslims constitute a minority. But if you make a list of countries with the highest number of foreign fighters per capita per its Muslim population, Kosovo's in the bottom half of that list, ranked like 14th out of 22, with Finland and Belgium being the top. as to why these people joined ISIS, what the media has said is that there's a spike in Wahhabism funded by Saudi Arabia to take over Muslim souls in Kosovo and turn them into jihadists. And it's certainly true that there's been a concentrated effort by Gulf countries to spread Wahhabism all over the world and in Muslim parts of the Balkans. And I'll definitely admit that there's a strong impact of Saudi Arabia introducing more conservative ideas. But we have to be careful not to conflate those conservative ideas with extremism. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that Saudi Arabia was a core or even direct cause of pulling people towards violent extremist groups in Syria. Rather, I think you need to look at sort of the socio-political context, and this issue needs to be addressed from a far more complex and nuanced lens. Prior research on European jihadists shows that the conditions for jihadism in Kosovo are actually pretty ripe, given that this country is the poorest in Europe with the highest youth unemployment rate. And to add complications to the matter, 67% of male fighters had a criminal record prior to traveling.
Uh-huh.
Also, the geographic proximity to Syria, the lack of visa restrictions to Turkey, and the low transportation costs made the trip just pretty logistically easy. And then, not lastly, but also, finances appear to have been a potentially enabling, but definitely not a main factor. There were videos circulating online of pools and mansions for fighters. But then when I spoke to a lot of the families of returnees, they really wanted to blame the Kosovo government, claiming that the government supported their decision to go to Syria to fight against the Assad regime. And at the time, there was no indictment for going to Syria and doing this in 2012, 2013.
It's, as to be expected, it seems to be a really complicated mix of factors as to why so many Kosovans were heading to Syria. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what the Kosovan authorities have been doing to try and, or were trying to do to stop the movement of people to Syria.
Well, since 2013, when they realized that actually these people weren't just joining one unified opposition force, but they were fragmented and many violent extremist groups had popped up, the Kosovo police have since indicted more than 120 terrorist suspects and arrested many more, including the sweeping crackdown on well-known conservative imams. And then since April 2018, the U.S. Department of Justice has helped implement a rehabilitation program to terrorism charged suspects. A good thing about the rehabilitation program is that one of the program designers told me that all extremists and extremist inmates are going to be formally assessed to better understand that story and to determine their psychosocial needs. But when I was there, I hadn't seen this program being implemented.
So I imagine now the rehabilitation program is going to become more vital than ever, because Kosovo hit the headlines a few weeks ago for being one of the first countries to do a mass repatriation of its citizens back to Kosovo, citizens who have been living in Syria. Mainly it was children, 74 children, 32 women and 4 men. And it's in stark contrast to what many other European countries are doing following the fall or perceived fall of IS in Syria. Do you have a feeling around how prepared they are for these returning citizens and whether this rehabilitation program is going to be successful?
I mean, I definitely want to just say that I applaud their efforts, because under international law, countries are obliged to allow their nationals to return home, and Kosovo isn't any different. In terms of rehabilitation, a lot of Western countries have stronger prison infrastructure and more long-term social welfare systems in place with a lot more money and resources to pool than Kosovo does. In terms of how effective the rehabilitation program will be, the verdict is still out. And the truth is that all of Europe is struggling with these issues, and every program is sort of experimental because no one knows for sure what works best. Some more uplifting news, I guess, in this regard is that, I mean, of the men who have already been indicted, they will be serving longer sentences. The majority of the male combatants won't be released in the coming several years. It's more long-term, 5-10 year process. So that will hopefully give Kosovo a chance to fully work with these individuals on a case-by-case basis, which really needs to be done.
And could you tell me a bit about what the circumstances are that have created the political will for this large-scale repatriation to happen? As you say, like, it hasn't happened in most other countries, even if under international law it should have happened. Why is it able to happen in Kosovo?
So you might think it's because of EU political influence, because Kosovo has been trying to join the EU amongst other Balkan states. But I think this actually may complicate things because, as we've said, most EU states have stalled on this process. And so they even see it as a danger to bring back these citizens, these women and children, because they could spread radical ideas in society or whatnot. I think if anything, the political influence was pressure from the U.S., I mean, President Donald Trump called on European countries to take back captured ISIS fighters, children, women. You know, all of Kosovo's actions have to be seen in the backdrop of the U.S. interference after the Kosovo War. And not that this is necessarily correct or not, but as sort of being seen as the liberators for stopping this campaign of ethnic cleansing. So I think this is why Kosovo did this, to sort of appease the U.S. And it works really closely with the U.S. embassy, even on de-radicalization efforts. And the U.S. embassy has applauded their move, stating that Kosovo has set an important example for members of the global coalition to defeat ISIS. And then the chief of police also said that their aim wasn't to make sure that only that citizens aren't part of foreign conflicts, but also to take measures about the ones that were in these zones and to rehabilitate them back into society. So I applaud Kosovo for this step, and I think it's the right move for all countries.
I guess it's an unusual example of hearing that a Trump policy is leading to kind of a humane treatment of citizens. That's kind of bizarre. I was wondering, do you know anything about what the plans are to help the children who are returning? Because their reintegration is, I imagine, going to be particularly challenging.
Right. So authorities aren't saying a lot of things in public, but they have some plans. The government said it drafted a program of rehabilitation and reintegration for children, which is important. I mean, I saw videos of young Kosovars, Albanians, shooting guns with jihadist fathers in ISIS training camps in Manbij in northern Syria. So anyone who is living under these circumstances for several years definitely needs help. But I think it's too early to talk about the intricacies of what that plan will look like, because they're dealing with the courts. And I even think the kids as well will be prosecuted. That's what sources on the ground have told me. The women and the children are being held inside this compound built for refugees. And the state, as I said, is sort of considering a soft approach for these women, because some of the women have repented for their adventure, claiming they've been manipulated by their husbands, who in the meantime were killed in combat. But then there's others who are said that they're proud of their choice. In general, it seems like everyone, especially the kids, are quite traumatized. And so the authorities are just dealing with this and investigating who has returned.
Should we do an interview together again sometime, Katie?
Eventually, that'd be nice, yeah.
We won't actually do it next week, will we? Because we have a special episode next week.
Yes, we will.
You may have heard us talk about it last week, but if not, just to remind you, we're going to have like a special series of episodes about bursting the bubble of Brussels. That's why one of the reasons why Katie's been there has been to do some research, trying to find out about the European Parliament and explain it in a way that is not going to put you to sleep. Hopefully she's also going to explain it to me, because I've been busy in rehearsal. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, Katie.
I'm getting super into it. And it was actually really nice to be back in Brussels again this week. So I went partly to do some work on this special episode, but mostly I went because I was invited to host a talk for the first time in my life, which was very exciting. So I got to hold a microphone on the main stage of the Ancienne Belgique concert venue. That stage has had people like Iggy Pop on it and The Cure and stuff.
And now Katie Lee.
And now me. So it wasn't quite as rock and roll as that, but it was really fun. And I was there hosting an event for Live Europe, which is the company which runs the Ancienne Belgique and a bunch of other really cool music venues in Europe. And it was a discussion about how to make Europe less boring in general. And it was really fun. And one of the other people taking part in this discussion was Maxime Caligaro. He is a French writer, and he's written this novel. It's called Les Compromis. And it starts with a murder of a politician inside the European Parliament as she was investigating corruption, and then mysteriously turns up dead. which struck me as kind of weird because no one writes books set in the European Parliament. People will literally write books set in space, like gazillions of them, but not in Brussels. I guess most people just think it's not very promising as a dramatic setting for your book, your TV show. But Maxime, before he started his life of crime writing, he used to work at the Parliament, and he thinks that it's actually a really great setting for a thriller like the one that he's written. So after I got back from Brussels this week, I gave him a call to find out why. Without giving too much of the plot away, can you tell me a bit about this novel that you've written?
Basically, the plot goes as follows. A Green MEP is found dead in the European Parliament. She was in charge of a report following up the Dieselgate scandal. And she was found dead. And basically, the Belgian police can't get it to the European Parliament. They can't call on members of the European Parliament to be investigated because they have parliamentary immunity. And therefore, her assistant will start an investigation with the help of Brussels journalists.
Are you worried that your novel is going to give MEPs ideas?
Well, actually, I've discovered that a Swedish MEP has written a crime novel within the European Parliament at the exact same spot where we've found the body of the victim.
Oh, damn.
And a former MEP has reviewed the book on the radio, and he said that if he had to kill another MEP, this is precisely where he would have killed a political rival. That hasn't happened yet, but, you know, maybe.
I hope not, just to put that on the record. Well, what's so good about this spot where they get killed in these two books?
So basically, in front of the Hemicycle in Brussels, there is a huge contemporary sculpture, which is maybe 7 meters high.
Oh, the big silver thing.
Exactly. So it's very pointy, and it's just underneath the 12th floor where the president's office is. And, well, if you were to push someone from the 12th floor, that someone would ultimately end up either on the sculpture or in front of the Hemicycle. We're not too gory, therefore we had our victim landing in front of the Hemicycle. But the Swedish MEP I was talking about had her victim ending up on the sculpture.
Oh my God.
Tarantino style.
I can hear them putting up security fencing as we speak. it's pretty rare to hear about a novel set in Europe in the sense of being set in a European institution in Brussels. Why do you think authors have shied away from that setting so far?
I mean, most people in Europe think that Brussels is completely remote. People might think that the EU is very complex. One Austrian author has taken the time to spend several years in Brussels and has written a novel. It was in German. It's called The Capitals. And this Austrian author basically has set a novel within the European Commission. And he sold 350,000 books in Germany. So that's the proof that that's never been done before. But when it is done, it might sell, actually. I think, I mean, there are more fiction writers like myself or this Austrian novelist I told you about who are actually seeing the EU for what it is, a narrative paradise. I mean, I was talking to one of the screenwriters in a writing room was telling me that the worst thing that can happen for a screenwriter is to have a huge body of movies or TV series already done about one topic and say, look, if you want to do a new TV series about cops, there's so many things that have been done before, and therefore you're influenced by prejudices or cliches. EU is fantastic because it's virgin territory. Nothing has been written before. So now it's completely up to us to actually show the Parliament or the EU in a different light, in a human light. I mean, when we first met, you know, you were asking me, what do you think when I say Europe or the EU? And you told me that your vision of it was an old white male, probably a politician wearing a tie, where because I worked in the institution for so long, of course I've seen the old man with the tie, but I also see young MEP assistants running around. I see diplomats, I see activists, I see cleaners, I see baristas, I see people I flirted with, I see people I love or married. And so for me, this is very much a diverse place. But I understand people who've never actually pushed the doors of the institution can't actually picture that. So this is why I think we kind of have a duty now to show it as it is and show it to the world.
We were chatting the other day about how feeling European is something that's often reserved for either the really privileged among us who get to work in other countries, and also at the other end of the scale, like low-paid workers who move to other European countries in search of like opportunities. And you said something really interesting. You said that books and TV and other kind of cultural stuff could be a way for everyone else who's in the middle to get a sense of what it is to be European. And I just wondered if you could expand on that a little bit.
Well, you know, when you pick a 19th century novel and all of a sudden you're reading about Russia in the old days, you can actually feel what the people actually experienced at the time. When you're watching, I don't know, I mean, a TV series from America, I mean, I've never set a foot in New York, but I watched Friends as a kid and I could really root for these people. I mean, they had their own problems. They were drinking coffees I would never drink. They were wearing stuff I had never seen before. But then all of a sudden, I really felt for these guys. And I said, God, you know, maybe that could happen to me. Same thing if you watch an Iranian movie. I mean, the other day I was watching the movie A Separation about a divorce in Iran. I've got no clue about the Iranian legal system, but all of a sudden I could see the divorce of my own parents and I could really feel, you know, the struggles that they had. So I believe that literature in general, music or even TV is the way for people to connect and think, you know, actually these people might be very much having the same problem that I do. So yeah, I believe this might be a way to, at least for people to understand each other, but also for people to recognize that there might be a culture emerging. I mean, you know, we often talk about the European public space. I believe if it doesn't happen through music, art and culture, then, you know, it won't happen at all.
We need to go back to reality now for a moment for the happy ending.
Yes, back to reality. Grim reality. Or is it so grim?
It is a bit grim, but it definitely doesn't feel like reality. I'm coming back to talking about animals for the end of the episode.
Animal correspondent Dominic Kramer.
Oh my God, I love that.
That's your new job title.
So a group of parents at a school in Créon-Beldon in the southeast of France have enrolled 15 sheep at their children's school in what might be one of the most ingenious bits of parental protesting this century. A group of parents literally turned up to their children's school with 15 sheep. Actually, they turned up with 50 sheep, what? 15 of whom they enrolled in the school in order to draw attention to a cause that they believe very strongly in. They are angry. They're angry that following the departure of 5 of the 266 pupils at their school, the authorities said that they have to get rid of one of the 11 classes. They decided to make the numbers up in sheep, whilst making a clever dramaturgical point that authorities should not count children in the same way that we count sheep.
Oh, love it.
It's actually got like a really clever point, I think. They had a jovial ceremony for the new sheep pupils, which was enjoyed by teachers, parents and pupils alike. They even named one of the sheep Barbette.
Love it.
Oh, stop it. It's not clear yet whether this protest will have the desired effect on the authorities, but it has certainly given the issue attention in the media internationally. So good luck to the parents. I hear them.
This is like the spirit of French rebellion in action, and it makes me so happy.
It's really genuinely quite intelligent, I think.
Are you not going to end this on the sheep joke like you did with your bears?
No, sorry. Should I have?
The village authorities must be feeling pretty sheepish right now.
They should go to that school because there might be a child in sheep's clothing.
I don't understand that. That's terrible.
No, that doesn't work. We will be back next week with a special episode, and we've actually badly timed this special episode because it means we won't be able to talk about Eurovision, Katie.
This sucks. I was planning on spending the whole week's episode just talking about Eurovision nonstop.
Hopefully you all will forgive us if we talk about Eurovision the week after that, because it's very important.
Who are you voting for?
I don't know who I'm voting for. I haven't watched, but apparently they think the Netherlands are going to win. They're the bookies' favourite. Yeah, which means Eurovision in Amsterdam next year.
Sweet. That would be good.
But it's too soon to tell.
Vote France. That's what I say.
Vote Netherlands.
You can email us about your views on Eurovision or anything else that's on your mind at europeanspodcast@gmail.com, or you could talk to us on various social medias. You can talk to us on Twitter at europeanspod. We are on Instagram at europeanspodcast, and we're on Facebook. If you just type in the Europeans Podcast, you will find us. Before we go, I would like to give a big thanks to all the people who have been been really generously helping to keep the show going with their donations on Patreon. This week, special thanks to our super generous new supporters. I'm going to really mess up the pronunciation here. Victoria Giuciute and Vesa Mohonen. If you too would like to throw a little into the tip jar, you can do so at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast.
Thanks all for listening. Remember to tell your friends about us. It sounds really needy, but...
Please.
Please do.
Also vote for France. Bye.
Bye.